is Andrew Wallace versus Commonwealth, Mr. Hayden and Mr. Chandevel. And just to be sure, you both have you signed in, Mr. Chandevel?
I will do so.
Okay.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may.
Good morning again.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Mr.
May it please the court, my name is Charles Hayden, and I represent Andrew Wallace, who entered into a conditional plea of offered plea of guilty in the Newport News Circuit Court to one count of indecent liberties with a child, a person in a custodial or supervisory capacity. This conditional plea preserved a speedy trial issue that is asserted on appeal. We've assigned as error that the trial court erred in denying Wallace's motion to dismiss the charge against him where there were at least 156 days and possibly as many as 213 days attributable to the Commonwealth after probable cause was found by the district court, violating his statutory right to a speedy trial under 19.2-243. We have noted that there were clearly 76 days between the preliminary hearing on December 5th and the initial trial date in February of 2013, February 19th. In addition, there were either 67 or 80 days that occurred between the June 7th date and the August 13th or 26th, 2013 date. I note if the reason for a little confusion about whether it's 67 or 80 days is due to the order that's entered on June the 7th, 2013. It's on page 113 of the appendix. On June 7th, it says the Commonwealth, over the objections of the defendant, moved to continue the matter, and the court granted. And this matter is hereby continued until August 26th for trial before the Honorable Agent Vincent Conway, and whereupon the defendant noted his objection. That's the June 7th order. Then on page 115, there's the second order that was entered August the 13th of 2013. The defense counsel for Mr. Wallace moves to withdraw as counsel, and that request is granted. There's no request for a continuance from August 13th to some other date. It's just simply Mr. Roots moves to withdraw, Mr. Roundtree is appointed, and this order also sets over the trial date for the same August 26, 2013 court date. So it would appear to me that the orders, under either order, there's no change in the court date. It's just simply a change of counsel. And so it ought to be that the June 7th order prevails.
Well, didn't the defendant effectively concur in the further continuance once he made a motion for a new trial or request? I'm sorry, a new attorney?
He wasn't asking for even as of August 13th, the trial date is still set for August 26th. And so and they just simply reflect the fact that a new counsel is appointed, but it's still set for the same date that it was originally set for over the objection of defense counsel, August 26, 2013. So it seems to me that 13 days ought to be included. The amount ought to be 80 days rather than 67. And those two numbers right there put you at least 156 days. And that's clearly beyond the 152 and a fraction days that the statute speaks of. Therefore, he was entitled to have this matter dismissed. Beyond that, there was the second issue of an additional 57 days that was, there was a trial date that was set for January of 2000. January 14, 2014. On the day of trial, the prosecutor moves for a continuance due to a medical emergency of the prosecutor says, a substitute prosecutor shows up and says, we're moving for a continuance of this trial date today because the prosecutor yesterday had a medical emergency with her child, had to go to Duke University yesterday. And the judge granted the continuance over the objection of the defendant of another 57 days. And certainly, you know, the prosecutor herself had a valid reason for seeking that she could not try the case. However, this is in the Commonwealth Attorney's Office that has at least 20 other prosecutors, and the issue is...
Well, Mr. Haynes, if, you know, when we write an opinion, it applies in Newport News equally to Bath County. Suppose we take this case up to Bath County, and instead of having a medical emergency, the Commonwealth Attorney drops dead a week before trial. Does the defendant get to walk free because of that?
No. If it's a circumstance that is, I think the issue that the case law, the Schwartz case and the Beatty case that is cited in the brief, the Schwartz case talks about, is it a circumstance that's beyond the control of the judge or the prosecutor?
Well, are you suggesting that the prosecutor's fungible? That you could just pull one out of court and put another one in front of the jury and the Commonwealth is getting the same level of representation?
Well, there's always, it appears to me that the prosecutors are always reviewing their supervisors and other persons who are reviewing what the assigned prosecutor's work is doing, so there usually would be in the office of that size somebody reviewing the matter who can step in and take over the case. It's true that this thing happened the day before the trial, but how many days in advance do the prosecutors prepare anyway? I mean, they usually do it on the day before.
I spent 30 years doing that kind of work, and I'm not sure that I agree with that.
Well,
if we were to require, for instance, an assistant public defender to pick up the defense of a sex assault case a few days before trial, I suspect that would be reviewed by appellate courts beyond us. The rules of professional responsibility apply to prosecutors, defense attorneys alike, and one of those rules talks about diligence and adequate preparation and responsibilities to clients. And I don't see how we can say that this is not beyond the control of the prosecutor when the person who has prepared the case for trial is not available. Why that under Moten doesn't become a similar excuse to those listed in the statute?
I just note that what the Beatty's case and the Schwartz case says is that statutory exceptions, quote, contemplate that circumstances beyond the control of the trial judge and the parties may warrant a delay in a trial to ensure a fair trial to both the accused and the Commonwealth. So the issue is that beyond the control of trial judge and the parties, the Commonwealth can have in place procedures to deal with, if some prosecutor suddenly is not able to, a particular prosecutor has a breakdown of the car on the. It just there. There's surely that it's certainly something that is reasonably foreseeable on the part of the Commonwealth that in an office that size that you have backup plans in place to deal with if for some reason the prosecutor quits or whatever. There's always the supervisors. It's, I would respectfully submit, not beyond the control of the Commonwealth to deal with this sort of situation. Ultimately, that 57 days, the case doesn't rise or fall on the 57. That just gets it up to 213 days. But we're already at the 156 if we got the 13 days that was specified over objection of defendant in the June 7th order. So at this point, I'll rest. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Okay, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. Chris Chandel for the Commonwealth in this appeal. Although there are two assignments of error, the primary issue in this case is whether or not there is a statutory speedy trial violation. The Commonwealth prevails on that assignment of error, then it should also prevail as to the constitutional issue because this court decided in Scheer that the length of the delay is the triggering mechanism to even get to the other factors in the constitutional consideration. So we would suggest that primary focus should be whether there is a statutory violation and that there are really only two time frames that are contested by the parties. The first is that 13-day period between August the 13th and August 26, 2013, and the second is that continuance for the sudden medical emergency of the prosecutor's son, which occurred on January the 14th of 2014, is when that continuance was entered. It's Commonwealth's position that there were 142 days properly attributable to the Commonwealth in this case and not excused by either enumerated or implied exceptions. And so those 140 days, of course, fall short of the 152 and a fraction the statute allows for. Now, because of that, the Commonwealth needs both those two time frames to be either excusable or accountable against the defendant. And so that first time period, that 13-day delay from August the 13th through August the 26th of 2013, as has been pointed out, there is a continuance order in the record at page 30 of the appendix where that case was continued from August the 13th to August the 26th on motion of the defendant. And that's a quote from the order itself. And, of course, statute makes an exception for any continuances that are on motion of the defendant or concurred in by the defendant. And so that would certainly suffice there to make that 13-day period attributable to the defendant. Now, my opponent points out the fact that the case had already been continued over his client's objection all the way until August the 26th before he started writing letters asking for a new attorney, which ultimately led to his attorney withdrawing and this continuance being entered on his motion. I would point the court to this court's decision in Heath versus Commonwealth, which is at 32 VA App 176, where the court said that it doesn't matter if the court had already been delayed or continued on the Commonwealth's motion when the defendant came in and told the court he was not prepared for trial. In Heath, the Commonwealth had delayed the start of trial because they had requested blood tests from the defendant. And so the case had been continued out and no fixed trial date had yet been set. And then before that matter could be resolved, the defendant came in and said and made a motion for a competency evaluation. And so the case was continued from that date forward. And the court in Heath, this court, said that the time period from the defendant's motion for continuance for a competency evaluation going forward is attributable to him, notwithstanding the prior delay attributable to the Commonwealth. So that 13-day delay is properly attributable to the defendant. On the medical emergency continuance of January 14, 2014, as this court knows, the enumerated exceptions in Code Section 19.2-243 are not all of the exceptions. The court, going all the way back to 1851 in Commonwealth versus Adcock, has recognized that there are implied exceptions that can be properly included within Virginia's speedy trial statute. And the test that the court gave us in Adcock as to whether or not an exception is properly implied under that statute is, first of all, whether the new exception is of a similar nature to any of the enumerated exceptions, and second, whether it's based on the same rationale as in any of the enumerated exceptions. And so as the Commonwealth has argued on brief, this an implied exception for a medical emergency of the lead prosecutor's child is certainly similar to two exceptions already enumerated expressly, one for the defendant being confined for mental health purposes or even in a hospital, the second for material witnesses being kept away for some sort of illness. And so an exception here would be similar to those two exceptions. It's also based on the same reasoning, which would be fairness to the Commonwealth. That is a reason that's been used to justify some of the other exceptions throughout the case law. We would submit that prosecutors are not fungible, particularly on the day before a jury trial. So we might have a different case if this medical emergency had come up 2, 3, 4 weeks before the date set for jury trial. We might have a different case if there were multiple prosecutors working on the case.
If we assume that that first continuance was attributable to the defendant, and we're speaking only about the continuance resulting from the unavailability of the prosecutor, when would the speedy trial have run? You
know,
any idea?
On my reading of the record, the Commonwealth was at 142 days at that point. So if you take January 14th and add 10 days in a fraction, that's when the speedy trial date was run, absent that continuance being excused for an implied exception.
So if the trial court wanted to get that within the speedy trial date when the prosecutor became unavailable, he or she would have had to set that case within 10 days for trial.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. That's my reading of the record. And of course, in this case, there was no reason that the court should have been compelled to do that. There's no reason the court should have been compelled to require the Commonwealth to bring in a prosecutor who had never seen the case, who had never talked to the child witness involved in this case, who lived out of state. There were some statements made about the uniqueness of this particular case and dealing with the child witness and the difficulty of having a new prosecutor come in the day of trial and try a case such as this. The court made a fact finding on page 40 of the appendix that the lead prosecutor's presence was vital and material to this case going forward on the date that was initially set for trial. So I would argue that even if this court wants to avoid a broad ruling that any case that a prosecutor turns out can't be available on the day of trial, a case like this where the prosecutor's presence is vital and material and the emergency comes up the day before trial, an implied exception should be inferred from the exceptions enumerated in the statute. Moving to the constitutional issue, of course.
Before you move on with
sure.
that one, you know, I understand what the Supreme Court has said in Hudson, but at some point, are we usurping the authority of the General Assembly when we carve out these exceptions that aren't in the statute?
So my response would be the response of the Supreme Court of Virginia in 1851. And the fact that the legislature has at no time in the 160, however many years since 1851, made any efforts to amend the statute to clarify and say these are all the exceptions. We're occupying the field and not allowing for implied exceptions. In that Commonwealth versus Adcock case, the Supreme Court reviewed the history of Virginia's speedy trial statutes and noted the fact that the Virginia courts had repeatedly implied new exceptions which were not enumerated by the General Assembly. And the General Assembly's response was not to come back and say, no, these are all the exceptions, we meant what we said, no more can be implied. The General Assembly's response was to come back and codify, essentially, the exceptions that the courts had already recognized. And so in Adcock in 1851, the Supreme Court interpreted the General Assembly's actions to mean that implied exceptions by the courts were permissible and that was something the General Assembly allowed for and actually took into consideration in enumerating the statute, the exceptions that are in the statute. So that would be the court in Adcock even deals with the canon of statutory construction, expressio unius alterius, and my Latin's not very good, but that once the General Assembly acts and lists certain exceptions, that excludes all other exceptions. And the court in Adcock said, in this particular case, we reach the opposite conclusion because of the way that the General Assembly has repeatedly codified what the courts had done. So that decision in Adcock is still good law, and I think it's still fair to assume today, since the General Assembly has not acted to change that, that exceptions can be permissibly implied from those that are expressly enumerated. Then, of course, my earlier point on the constitutional issue, if the court decides that there was no statutory speedy trial violation, that really ends the analysis, because that's the first prong on the constitutional consideration, and that is the triggering mechanism to even reach the other factors in that analysis. So for all of these reasons, unless there are additional questions from the court, we would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Hayden.
I'd like to have a few minutes left.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to touch on the AG's brief talking about the 13-day delay and contending that that should be attributable to the defendant because he requested new counsel. They referred to the order of June 7th that was set forth in two places in the appendix, page 30 and also on the page, I believe, 113. The AG cites the Heath case for the proposition that when a defendant's motion affirmatively demonstrates that he's not ready for trial, the period affected by the resulting order must be subtracted from the time the defendant was held in custody awaiting trial after his preliminary hearing, cites the Heath case from 2001. And, well, I would just note, does the motion that's set forth in page 29, the motion to appoint new counsel, does it, quote, affirmatively demonstrate that the defendant is not ready for trial on August the 26th? No. There's no request for continuance. They just say, appoint new counsel on August the 13th, which the court does, enters an order, and leaves the trial date at the same date originally set, the June 7th order, which is August the 26th. So the motion does not affirmatively demonstrate the defendant was not ready for trial. He's, in fact, just simply leave the trial date at the what's been originally set. And therefore, you do not subtract that 13 days from the 80-day period of continuance. He noted in the Heath case, the Supreme Court's conclusion was not altered by the fact that the motion was made when no trial date had been fixed and the trial of the case was delayed, had been delayed by the Commonwealth. Well, in this case, a trial date was set. And so Heath is not applicable to that extent. That in this case, there was a trial date set, nobody's requested change it, and in fact, the order specifies the trial date remains the same. Therefore, the time period should include those 13 days. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Yeah.